Up front next, breaking news, the deal to silence Stormy Daniels. Her former attorney explaining in vivid detail how he believed Trump was behind the payment to keep Daniels quiet. I was in the courtroom, and I'll tell you what I saw today, sitting about 25 feet away from Trump. Plus, breaking news, New York City's mayor just announcing the chaos on Columbia's campus needs to end now, and there is a heavy police presence lining up outside the campus. We're going to take you there live. Our reporter is there on the scene. And Trump telling a reporter there's a, quote, enemy from within, more threatening than China or Russia, and says people like a dictator. A reporter who spoke to Trump is my guest. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett, and we want to begin with some breaking news on the campus of Columbia University right here in New York. There is a heavy NYPD presence right outside Columbia, where pro-Palestinian protesters have taken over the campus, occupied buildings, broken windows. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has just announced, quote, this must end now, telling the parents of students at Columbia to call their kids right now and tell them to leave the area before the situation, quote unquote, escalates. Miguel Marquez is on the scene out front at Columbia University. So, Miguel, you are amidst these crowds. Can you tell us exactly what you're seeing?
It is a little confusing here, but I'm going to walk you through it. These protesters that we're now following have been out in front of Columbia for most of the day, many, many hours now. They were on the Amsterdam side, and they came around to the Broadway side, the main gates of Columbia. That's when police moved in. They shut down Broadway completely, both directions in front of the university. They're bringing in tons of barricades. Lots of tow trucks and police buses as well are starting to take position and a much increased police presence as well. It is very clear that something's going down at Columbia tonight. As these protesters were protesting in front of the gate, they then started marching. We are now just near 131st Street and Broadway, marching into Harlem at the moment. It's not clear where they're going, but it does seem clear that something, that the police will likely move in to remove protesters from that building and the encampment on the campus of Columbia University. Erin?
Miguel, quick question to you. I know there have been students occupying the buildings today. You know, we'd seen pictures of broken windows. Do you have any sense of how many students are still there or how many are leaving in advance of what seems to be a pretty clear soon move from the NYPD?
It is not clear. The police believe there's, and the university believes there's 200 to 300 students total taking part in this. Keep in mind, there are about 36,000-37,000 students at Columbia University, so the entire university is sort of being disrupted by these 200. It sounds like a small percentage of that, of those 200 or 300, have moved into Hamilton Hall, which is, it's a place that students have taken over many times over the years to voice their displeasure with certain policies, whether it's at the school or otherwise. But it sounds like there's 200 to 300. It's not clear how many of them have taken up the university's offer to sign a form and not be expelled or suspended. But right now, all those students face expulsion and suspension and probable expulsion. Erin?
All right, Miguel, thank you. Well, Miguel, live amidst that crowd of protesters right outside Columbia University. And as we, Miguel is saying, it's very clear the NYPD seems poised to go in. We are following that so we can show you exactly what happens here the moment that it does. As we wait for that, the other breaking story tonight, downtown in Manhattan. The quote, Trump is effed. And that was the quote that came from a text message that Stormy Daniels' former attorney sent to the National Enquirer right after the infamous Access Hollywood tape was released. That was part of key testimony in Trump's New York criminal trial. I was in the courtroom today. It's a small room. It's a quite intimate space where Daniels' former attorney, Keith Davidson, sat 15 feet or so away from Trump and spoke directly to the jury, laying out to them the sleazy back and forth negotiations over hush money payments that are at the heart of this case. Now, Davidson was very clear that the payments to the Playboy model Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels were made to influence the election. The prosecutor asking Davidson at one point, and this is the quote I wrote down, is it safe to assume from your joke that you had an understanding that if you were to close your deal, this would somehow benefit the candidate Donald Trump? Davidson's one word reply, yes. And he laid it out again and again, making it clear that he knew that this would influence the election and telling the jury that he believes Trump was behind it. Now, I was watching Trump and the jury today in the courtroom. As I said, a small space. Everybody is very close to each other. It's very personal. four witnesses and nearly 4 hours of testimony, and the jury paid attention the whole time. Some taking notes, most, though, from what I could see, just turning their heads to listen to the questions and then turning their head to listen to the answers, back and forth and fully engaged, sometimes looking at the screens in front of them to actually peer at very specific documents. And one thing that stood out to me was actually that they never noticeably ever looked at Trump. Even when they walked in and out of the courtroom, and I saw that about four times in total, I did not see any of them turn to look at him, even though they walk right in front of him as he's standing there. As for Trump, he also paid attention, sometimes listening with his arms folded, held, head tilted back, as you've heard. Sometimes he fully leaned back in his seat with his legs stretched out. He often spoke to his attorneys, but the time that he was most engaged that I witnessed was when a witness from C-SPAN was testifying, the witness confirming that Trump had spoken at various rallies. And then the prosecution played tapes from those rallies, including this one.
Every woman lied when they came forward to hurt my campaign. Total fabrication.
Now, at that point, when that started playing, it's short, and they played a few, Trump leans forward. He puts his face right close to the television monitor on the desk in front of him. He was riveted. Trump watching Trump was his most engaged and intense moment of the trial today that I saw. Meantime, when the story shifts to Stormy Daniels by name, Trump's lips were pursed. His disdain for Daniels, of course, coming as he has repeatedly attacked her despite a gag order. His supporters have threatened her and her family. Some of the attacks so vile, I will not repeat them on air, but in a moment, I will speak exclusively to Daniels' bodyguard. And tonight, the judge in the case, putting Trump on notice because of some of those attacks, warning Trump to stop violating the gag order or face time behind bars. That warning came after Trump was fined $9,000 in the courtroom this morning for making public comments about jurors and witnesses. What was interesting in this is watching Trump, as the judge fined him for every violation, didn't bat an eye. The former president was completely stoic from my vantage point. Paula Reed is out front live outside the courthouse to begin our coverage tonight. And Paula, what stood out to you most today?
Well, Aaron, the day began with reports of tension between Trump and his legal team. I'm told everything is fine between him and his attorney, Todd Blanche. And as you saw in court today, the two men appear to be completely aligned as they heard from several witnesses, including one that could really matter for this case, the man who represented two women who say they had affairs with Trump.
Today, jurors in the hush money case against former President Trump heard from a lawyer who represented two women who allegedly had affairs with him while he was married. Keith Davidson represented both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. He explained to the jury how he sought deals with the National Enquirer for both of his clients. He told the jury how the release of the Trump Access Hollywood tape suddenly drove up interest in Daniels' story.
I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet.
The jury was shown texts that Davidson sent to former National Enquirer editor Dylan Howard about both Daniels and McDougal. Of McDougal, Davidson texted, "I have a blockbuster Trump story." Howard responded, "Talk first thing. I will get you more than anyone for it. You know why." Davidson and McDougal were in conversation with ABC News about sharing her story, he testified, but McDougal did not want to tell her story and preferred the deal with the National Enquirer, which would have kept her story from the public. At one point, while Davidson and Howard were negotiating, Davidson wrote, "Throw in an ambassadorship for me. I'm thinking Isle of Man." He said that text was a joke about Trump's presidential run, that somehow, if Karen did this deal for AMI, the publisher of the National Enquirer, that it would help Donald Trump's candidacy. Davidson said he received a hefty 45% of McDougal's $150,000 deal. Earlier in the day, prosecutors questioned other witnesses, like Michael Cohen's former banker, Gary Farrow, who provided details about a different hush money payment that was made to Stormy Daniels by Michael Cohen. Trump was seen leaning back in his chair with his eyes closed several times during Farrow's testimony. Prosecutors also briefly called the executive director of C-SPAN's archives to the stand. His testimony was used to enter videos of Trump into evidence.
As you have seen, right now I am being viciously attacked with lies and smears. It's a phony deal. I have no idea who these women are.
And before all the day's testimony began, Judge Juan Merchan ruled Trump must pay $9,000 for violating the gag order put in place at the start of the trial. The judge ruled Trump violated the gag order 9 times and charged him $1,000 per violation and ordered him to take down the offending post by the afternoon, which Trump did. The judge raised the possibility of jail time if Trump continues to violate the gag order, stating, "Therefore, defendant is hereby warned that the court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment."
After court, Trump made additional comments that all appeared to be within the bounds of his gag order. But when we're back in court on Thursday, the day will start with another hearing on what prosecutors say are 4 additional violations of the gag order. But Aaron, I'll note that these all occurred before Trump was fined $9,000 and threatened with jail. So too soon to say that is having a deterrent effect.
Right. Absolutely. And he did remove the posts, at least relevant to what he was punished for today. All right, Paula, thank you very much. Our experts are here with me. So Terry Austin, you and I sat together inside the courtroom and you have been there every single day. You're a former trial attorney. So how was, you know, in that context, how did you see Keith Davidson's testimony? He, of course, is the lawyer who represented both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal.
Aaron, I think he's been the best so far. He walked into that courtroom. He was very confident. He got on that stand. He answered the questions, and he was very detailed about it. And he was funny. He made jokes. You mentioned one of the jokes that he made, the Isle of Man, and I definitely think the jury was listening to him. He was extremely credible, and he gave a lot of details about both the Stormy Daniels case and about the Karen McDougal case.
Yeah, and he turned towards the jury. I mean, he's a lawyer. He knew what he was doing. I mean, not that others didn't, but he was very purposeful in his take the question and really present to them.
Absolutely.
All right, so Ryan, there was another moment that stood out to me. Michael Cohen's banker was testifying, completing his testimony. The prosecution's going document by document how Michael Cohen set up a new corporation. And what was the purpose for the corporation? They show documents. And again, the jury's watching this so carefully. What did Michael Cohen say the purpose of the new corporation was? Real estate consulting. What was the purpose of the wire to Daniels' attorney? Retainer. Then the prosecutor asked Cohen's banker if Michael Cohen had indicated the funds would be used to pay an adult film star as opposed to real estate consulting, would this all have happened? The corporation had been opened so quickly, the money transferred and wired out. The answer was unequivocal. That is an industry we do not work with. Mm-hmm. So how far does this go to proving the falsification of documents that are so central to the case?
Well, it certainly proves that the scheme was being used. They were using shell companies. They were using all sorts of falsities with the banks and otherwise. So that was from the get-go. Now, the problem is that right now, that's just Michael Cohen.
Right.
And the big question for this trial is whether or not the prosecutors can prove that Donald Trump himself knew that business records were being falsified to cover up the entire scheme. But those are the business records inside the Trump Organization. But this is a very good lead into that particular
right.
part of it.
So we don't know what they have, Joey, but certainly today they presented a good case for Michael Cohen providing false representation, but not Donald Trump.
Yeah, without question. And aerial view, you know, Aaron, I'm fascinated by your description of the volley between the jurors focusing on the answers and the questions. That's critical and not looking at Trump. And that's important. Trump's not providing testimony, right? What the testimony's coming from the witnesses mm-hmm. shows to me they're paying attention, keeping an open mind. People have their minds made up, but doing anything but listening to testimony. You know, but look, on the issue of establishing the deal being what? He represented the attorney Davidson, who was testifying today. He represented Stormy Daniels, right? Certainly represented Karen McDougal, had a lot to say about his interactions with Michael Cohen. What I would anticipate when is the defense's argument that, listen, that's great as to your relations with Michael Cohen. What about Donald Trump? You didn't interact with him at all, did you? You were interacting with Michael Cohen. You have no knowledge with respect to any conversations that took place between Trump and Cohen. You don't know what at all they were discussing at any time because you weren't there. So yeah. Fascinating as to their interaction, Cohen and Davidson, who didn't have such great things to say about Cohen, by the way.
Right? No.
Calling him things I can't repeat. But we'll see what the defense does, certainly in closing argument, seizing upon that to say Trump was nowhere to be seen, nowhere to be found, and had nothing to do with this.
That's what they're going to try to say. All right, so Terry, when we were sitting there, something happened that hadn't happened before. You've been in every day, so you knew to be surprised when Eric Trump walked in with his father. They walk in. I described it to someone today as sort of in the traditional sense of a wedding, walking down the aisle. They walk in a procession. You get, you know, the defense and the prosecution. So in Trump comes with his son. And then Trump turns and looks towards us because that's, you know, to face his son. They have a conversation, a brief one. What did you make of that interaction?
I think some of it was staged, no doubt about it. They do come in the exact same way every day. In fact, they line up the same way. The same people carry the same boxes. It's pretty interesting. And when Trump turned around to talk to Eric, he looked around the room. He saw you. Right. And he saw other people, and he smiled. And he was doing that, I think, to show the jury that he's comfortable, he was relaxed, his son is there, his family supports him. It was a very pivotal move.
Right, it's like he knew what he was doing. He said to me, "How are you?" he mouthed, you know, to you know, but he knew everyone in the room was
looking
at him at
absolutely.
That moment. How important, Ryan, is it for him to have family there? I mean, Eric Trump, is this the first time he's been there, or anyone's been there? Does that matter in a courtroom like this, a small courtroom where everyone in that jury is well aware that someone from Trump's family's there?
I think it matters a lot. It also matters a lot because of the nature of the case. So it's hush money payments to women that he's
right,
allegedly having affairs
with.
That's right. So if the family's there to support him, that's a big deal.
So you're saying if Melania shows up?
That would be a big deal. But I think her absence is also highly significant. And in fact, Eric showing up on one day, and then if they don't, the others don't show up, I think it would be even more significant that they're not there, Melania especially.
So, Joey, you know, we heard from, you know, a witness today that may seem odd to some people, which was the head of archives for C-SPAN. And he was very open about being nervous. And he was there for one purpose only, which was in order for the prosecution to get those tapes, of which I played a clip and Paula played a clip, into the record, because the two sides hadn't been able to agree on that. So now you got to waste witness time to get that into as an exhibit. So, you know, what do you make of Trump's reaction to that? I mean, as I said, you know, I don't want to mess up all our cameras here, but he leans forward. His face is so close to his little television monitor when he saw himself.
Without question. So let's talk about just briefly, it's a little inside baseball as to why that witness is there.
Yeah.
We lawyers have to lay the foundation, right? You can't just say, I'm admitting this into evidence. And if another lawyer doesn't agree, then you have to call the actual person to authenticate the document, present it to him. It's a business record. It goes in. Then you could play it for the jury. So that's the essence of why this is important. Now, most trials, Aaron, what happens is we just agree. It, you know, don't call anybody. Like, it's going into
we
evidence.
All know we'll he did it. A rally in Greensboro, North Carolina on right. this date, right? We don't need C-SPAN to confirm it.
100%. But I think critically what the video show. I don't know these women. I don't know anything about it. Meanwhile, if you connect the dots, you heard other testimony. You even heard Rhoda, his administrative assistant. Yep, they won the contacts. Stormy Daniels was in the contact list of the Trump Organization.
Yep.
Right? So was Karen McDougal. Oh, and by the way, Stormy Daniels had an interview at some point. It may have been for The Apprentice. We don't know. So it just goes to show.
Right. Right.
That he's misrepresenting. If he's misrepresenting about that, what else is he misrepresenting?
And is that what you think the purpose of this was? Not to eventually prove that he did indeed have affairs with these women, but certainly he knew them. Karen McDougal, he referred to as our girl.
Correct. Our girl. We saw that in some of the communications. Yeah, absolutely. This was a lot of to-do about just small points, but there's small points. We're going to see that during the closing arguments, these points where he is lying to you about these affairs, and you can't believe anything he's saying, obviously, and that's why they took the time to make sure they brought in the C-SPAN guy and anybody else they needed to be the custodian of records to get into the
right,
evidence.
Even somebody who had taken a deposition, E. Jean Carroll,
exactly.
And there's a lot of that. All right. Thank you all very much. And next, Stormy Daniels sharing exclusively the violent, disturbing threats that she's receiving now, including Trump supporters threatening to physically abuse and kill her family. The longtime bodyguard is next. Plus, breaking news out of New York, we are just learning that hundreds of officers from the NYPD Strategic Response Team have just arrived outside Columbia University. Mayor Eric Adams speaking out moments ago. We're live on the ground there as those teams approach. And Trump has always wanted to live the Playboy life.
Have you ever dated a playmate?
I refuse to answer that question.
On the grounds that it may be true?
It may be true.
Could a playmate be the one who ultimately takes him down?
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
If you don't have the basics, like food and shelter, obviously that's a problem.
That's Lori Santos. She's a cognitive scientist and she's a professor at Yale University, where she teaches college students all about the science behind what it really means to be happy.
All too often, our accomplishments wind up being at an opportunity cost of the stuff that really makes us happy.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, quote, "You're on your way to hell." That is just one of the many obscene and vile threats against Stormy Daniels and her family. These threats have intensified as Daniels prepares to possibly take the stand against Donald Trump. Daniels exclusively sharing some of the threats against her with OutFront tonight. And I want to warn you, these are disturbing. I mean, one of them reads, "Evil will never win. The truth will come out. And I don't know how you live with yourself. It's time you better find God because you're on your way to hell." And there's another one that is so vile that I will only share part of it aloud. "I'm going to physically abuse your entire family for what you've done to this country. This is a death threat, and I swear to God, I will murder you." It goes on to threaten unspeakable acts to her family members, male or female. Yet Daniels tonight, in the face of all this, is defiant. She tells OutFront, quote, "No amount of threats will change what happened. The truth is the truth." Joining me now exclusively is Daniels' bodyguard, Travis Miller. And you can see him here holding Daniels' hand as she makes her way through a crowd of reporters. Whoa. Travis, this image shows what you have been doing, protecting Daniels since 2018, so throughout all of this. The threats against her tonight, we just shared some of them, terrifying, difficult to hear. Have the threats against her ever been this bad?
I don't think so. You know, I think starting out, you know, there were levels of threats, and I think at this point it's definitely gotten worse, you know. And my biggest thing is just trying to give her peace of mind during this process, and protect her as much as possible.
I mean, if Daniels does come to New York to testify in this trial, obviously, Travis, you're going to be the person in charge of protecting her. How worried is she about facing Trump supporters? Some of them are very angry. Some of them have threatened violence against her. He has been encouraging them to come outside the courthouse.
Yeah, yes, ma'am. I mean, you know, she's worried. You know what I mean? But at the end of the day, I think, you know, she trusts me. She trusts herself, and I think the biggest thing is just protecting her and just giving her as much peace as possible during this process. And just protecting her. That's the most important part of it.
And, you know, when you talk about that, Travis, you are her bodyguard. You also, in working with her, become her friend. And Stormy shared some photos of the two of you with us. And she, you know, talked about you. She tells us, quoting about you, Travis, "I know Travis would die for me, my daughter, and even her father. He is the first person to believe me. He knows danger and doesn't hesitate to protect me." And she tells us, Travis, that you've saved her life more than once. What do you want us to know about her as a person?
She's an amazing person, you know, and she's an even better mom. You know, when it comes to who she is, she's loyal. And when I first met her, I saw that right away. And I made her a promise that I would stand by her side from the start to the end. And I plan on keeping that promise. And, you know, and I take a lot of pride in what I do, and I take a lot of pride in keeping my word on protecting her and her family, and I will continue to do that.
Travis, Stormy just posted a seemingly benign comment on X, and she writes the other day, "Such a beautiful afternoon at the farm. That's what she wrote. And one user attacks her for it and says, this case is falling apart in real time and your ability to remain relevant with it. And she could have ignored it, but she chose to respond. Are you watching the same case that just had two witnesses prove everything I've been saying is the truth? And Travis, I mean, she was, you know, unafraid, immediately responded. Do you think we're going to see this defiance, this willingness to take it all on the witness stand?
I mean, it's not my place to say anything about that when it comes to that. But she's a fighter. And if it's one thing you've noticed about Stormy is that no matter how hard she gets hit, she keeps getting back up. And she stays true to who she is. And she never wavers. And I think that's the most important thing when it comes to her.
All right. Well, Travis, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And, of course, we'll see if you will be in New York soon with her for that potential and quite likely testimony. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
And next, the breaking news here in New York. Let me just show you some live pictures of what's happening. NYPD officers lining up outside Columbia University. The mayor has spoken, saying this must end now. And just subsequent to that, all of these hundreds of officers have approached Columbia. Streets are closed. These are officers from the Strategic Response Team. They are now on the scene. And we're going to take you there next. Plus, Trump in a telling new interview threatening political violence if he doesn't win in November. The reporter who spoke to him will be out front. Breaking news at this moment. These are live pictures out of New York. Pro-Palestinian protesters have been on the streets as police right now that you are looking at on your screen. These are police lined up outside Columbia University. There's major gates right there on the inside, the quad where those tents were, the hall that students occupied overnight, and now these police officers all gathering. Our Shimon Procupes reporting hundreds of officers from the Strategic Response Team, that's who you're looking at, he says, have just arrived, and he witnessed dozens of vans and then all of these officers getting out. The New York mayor, Eric Adams, warning students who are right now barricaded inside one of the school's main buildings called Hamilton Hall to leave immediately. He says their protest has been hijacked by outside agitators who are, quote, creating serious public safety issues.
Maybe some of the students involved don't understand what they are involved in. We urge those and everyone else violating Columbia's order to leave the area and leave the area now. We cannot wait till this situation becomes even more serious. This must in now.
Now, the president of Columbia University is threatening to expel students who took over that building on campus overnight, breaking windows, blocking doors with tables. The protesters are showing no signs of leaving right now. Palestinian flag was waving from the rooftop today of that hall. Right now on the ground, Shimon Procupes is there and Miguel Marquez. They're right outside Columbia, two different points, but you can see what's happening here. So, Shimon, let's start with you. I see a lot of those police officers behind you. What's happening?
No, this is certainly an escalation. These are the officers who respond to any kind of disturbance, protests. I've been in New York covering protests for quite some time. I've not seen a response like this before. These are the surge teams that they send in moments like this. And right now what we've been seeing here is that this is where they're gathering, just waiting for word on whether or not they're going to be going in. We heard the chief here giving them some last minute orders that once they go in to put their visors down because objects could be thrown at them. He told them to be officers. He told lieutenants to be lieutenants and sergeants to be sergeants and to be professional. They were going over some of the strategic moves, the design of the interior of the campus where the encampment is, having some last minute words. And we're seeing a lot of them just stand around at this point very calmly, just waiting for word on whether or not they're going to be going into the college, which is over my right shoulder here, just a couple of blocks. So at some point, it seems that they're just going to do this. It's just a question of when, and they're just waiting for word. I want to show you here, Aaron, behind me here, there are more officers gathering. Some of them I were preparing, you see zip ties and other gear. There's also the NYPD legal unit as well there. Everyone at this moment, Aaron, is just standing by to see whether or not the college, they're waiting for permission from the college to give them that permission, that letter, that legal authority to head in into the university. But this kind of response, this is a massive, massive response here. And more officers are arriving here. We're seeing chiefs and other high-ranking officers, everyone here at the ready, on word that they're going to be moved in. What's happened here, Aaron, it seems, you know, based on what the NYPD and the mayor have said, is that they have information, very concerning information, that has caused safety concern. And as a result of that, they have closed pretty much both sides of Broadway for about 10 blocks. I've never seen anything like this, that where they've closed both sides of the street here in Morningside Heights, and they are now just gathering and preparing for perhaps the next steps here. The warning has been given, and now we just wait, Erin.
All right, Shimon, while you're there, I just want to go just nearby to where you are, but a different vantage point to Miguel Marquez. And Miguel, what can you tell us you're seeing from where you're standing?
Yeah, it seems very clear that police and the university want these protests to end, and they want it to end tonight. This is Broadway. These are the main gates to Columbia here, 116th and Broadway. You can see what it looks like. Broadway is shut down in both directions for several blocks. Amsterdam, all the way on the other side. We have a camera on Amsterdam Avenue, all the way on the other side. I can see and hear protesters on that side of the campus. Amsterdam is also shut down. 120th and maybe 114, 112, those are also shut down right now. Police have staged dozens of tow trucks down at 120th. There are big buses down at 120th. They have several different areas that are now shut down. The protesters, interestingly, are staying over on the Amsterdam side. Maybe 200 or so protesters came over to the Columbia side a short time ago, about a half hour, 45 minutes ago, and then they marched off. They marched, we talked to you at the top of the show, they kept going up Broadway into Harlem. It's not clear exactly where they were going, if they were trying to protest and go around the city, but police did follow them there. But it is very clear tonight that the university has given these protesters warning. Look, they believe this is 200, maybe 300 individuals that they're dealing with, both the encampment and then in Hamilton Hall as well, that they will have to move people out of that encampment, which they've done before, and then they allowed it to take root again, and then it stayed, and now we are where we are. And then Hamilton Hall. It's not clear how many individuals are in Hamilton Hall. It sounds like it might be a fairly small number. I've spoken to students who are inside. So the only people that can get in here are essential workers and students who are in who room and have their dorm rooms in on the campus. I've spoken to students there. They said it's very, very tense in there. They're not seeing any sign of police inside the campus right now, but it is quiet, and they are expecting the NYPD to move in at some point this evening. Aaron?
All right. Miguel, stay with us as well. Charles Ramsey joins the conversation now, former Philadelphia police commissioner and D.C. police chief as well. So, Chief Ramsey, you know, you hear Shimon and Miguel describe what they're seeing right now. You know, Shimon talking about in all the protests he's covered, and he has covered so many over these recent years, that he's never seen surge teams this big. And they're going through plans, you know, actual plans of what the layout is inside the courtyard. They're being told to put their visors down, to be worried about projectiles when they go in. They're prepared with zip ties. When you hear all those details, what do you think?
Well, I think it's about time. I mean, this is something that really should have been done before, because this is just escalating to a point where it's no longer a peaceful protest. You can't break into a building, one of the university buildings, and take it over. I mean, you know, the university has allowed this to get to a point where right now force is going to have to be used to not only get rid of the encampment, but also get those people out of that particular building. So there'll be a lot of arrests that are made. Hopefully they hold true on their threat to expel the students that participated, particularly in taking over that building and causing damage. I mean, they got to send a message. And I would hope that universities around the country pay attention to this, and they need to coordinate with their local authorities and have a game plan, because these things get out of control very quickly.
So, Chief, there's Shimon was also sharing that why is this happening right now? Obviously, the occupation of that hall, which is something that students have done at various points over the years. But obviously, this time there's been violence, windows broken. The students are inside. Again, we don't know how many. But Shimon was saying that the reason for this happening right now in terms of these surge teams massing outside is that they've received, quote unquote, concerning information. Now, in the context of what these protests are about, when you hear concerning information and see surge teams like this, do you have any specific concerns as to what that information might have been?
Well, you have to have concerns whether or not anyone in there is armed, for an example. You know, anything is possible. You had a large number of people enter that building. They weren't searched, certainly, before they went in. So you don't know what they may have. You have to be prepared. And if nothing else, there are all kinds of projectiles can be thrown at police. You know, I went through the Vietnam War protests on college campuses, so I know it can get pretty ugly, and I have no reason to believe this won't get ugly because the people that have taken over this building, they want that optic. They want that visual. They want CNN and others to show the police, you know, forcibly removing people from the buildings and so forth. But guess what? That's exactly what's going to happen. Police will use a minimal amount of force in order to do it. But if they got to clear that building, they're going to clear that building, period.
All right,
I wish I was with
Chief Ramsey, stay with me. Shimon and Miguel are standing by as well, so all can hear us as this develops. Frank Bruni also joins me from the New York Times, the author of The Age of Grievance, which was just released today, which is a poignant moment for your book to come out. But when we hear all these details concerning information, put your visors down, zip ties at the ready, it doesn't seem that there's a peaceful end. And as the chief points out, certainly those who are still inside that building don't seem to want it to end in a peaceful, calm way.
No, they don't. They want the kind of boldest confrontation possible because that serves their aims. You know, Columbia has every right to clear this building out. The New York City, Eric Adams, the police force has every right. I hope this happens in as proportional and measured a way as possible. Otherwise, you are playing into exactly what they want, and we're just going to escalate the situation, and it's pretty escalated as is.
So Frank, I'm just trying to understand, and I know every situation because there's different individuals involved, right? But Yale and Brown today succeeded two different ways, but in negotiating, and so that the encampments were dismantled and things appear to be going back to normal. Some of the students, you know, in the case of one of the universities. Okay, look, at the police are walking here as we're talking, so we're seeing where they're going. As they do that, Frank, what do you think is different here about Columbia, where there's been no ability to tamp it down?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is I think everything that happens in New York City is on steroids, right? We don't know exactly who's in that building and what effect that has on it. I also think various political actors, and this is indicative of our grievance culture, various political actors have decided to choose this particular circumstance to come in and choose their sides and make their statements, and I think that has accelerated and amplified things. Mike Johnson, for example, the Speaker of the House. A week ago, I was writing about how much I admired the fact that he made common cause with Democrats, changed his mind about Ukraine aid, and then the next day or the day beyond that, he goes up to New York. He didn't need to be here, and he says, maybe we should bring in the National Guard. We have too many...
I was there, by the way, on the steps of Columbia when he was there, and he came out, and he said and did what he intended to do.
Right.
But he was clearly taken aback and surprised by how many students were there. And at that point, there were only a few hundred, but they gathered, and they were not happy. What he was expecting.
But did he need to do that? You know, so many of the voices that have joined this situation and have shouted about it, because that's what we do these days, we shout, we don't talk.
Yeah.
Have they been there to score political points and for their own purposes, or have they been there to really calm and solve this? I think this has been a sort of, this particular situation has attracted political actors scoring points in a way that the situations on some of those other campuses have not.
Right, maybe because it's Columbia.
It's Columbia.
He came, he brought three or four other representatives with him. I don't know, I was standing next to him. The students couldn't fully hear them.
Right.
And that was a good thing, Frank. Because if they had heard what they were saying, in one case saying, you all should be ashamed, I mean, there would have been a true outcry. The intention of them appearing was for the press conference part, not to actually talk to the students.
Right. They came here because New York City is the media capital. Where are you and I sitting right now? We're sitting in a studio in New York City. They came here because more cameras are here, more media companies are here than in any other city.
So, Chief Ramsey, I don't know if you can still hear me. Can you still hear me, Chief Ramsey? All right. So as Frank and I are talking, we were able to see, and you know, it's sort of dicey what our cameras can get pictures of or not right now, but we started to see those surge, some of the surge units start to move. And they weren't rushing. They were just moving purposefully. From being in situations similar to this, is that how it would go down? They would just walk onto campus, or would there be some sort of a, I don't want to use the word rush in a pejorative way, but a rush?
No, they won't rush. I mean, they're formed up in platoons and squads. They each have an assignment. They're probably anticipating having entrances blocked, so they have to get through that. They'll cover the front, the rear. I mean, they've given people a chance to get out of there. And it gets to a point where it's too late to leave. You know, we're coming in, and if you're in there, you're going to be arrested and you're going to be charged. And that's probably how it's going to go down. So right now, they're just getting it together so that they actually have a plan to make the entry. And that's what you're seeing. But it's not going to be just a rush in there. It'll be controlled. But again, once they're inside, I would imagine they're going to encounter some resistance. I agree. The force they use has to be proportional, but some force will have to be used because these guys apparently are not going to leave. And I would be surprised if the majority of them are even students. You have people that's what they do. They attach themselves to the legitimate protesters, and they cause all kinds of problems. And that's what I think you're looking at right here. And something's got to be done about it.
Yeah, it was just very fascinating. I mean, these kids were offered, the ones that are students, you know, that they would be able to not be expelled. You know, if they were just to sign papers to back off today, which at Yale and Brown, this has seemed to work to de-escalate. Right. Did not happen in this case. But when we look at the images of where, I don't know how many of them, people are in there and how many of them are students, but right now in Hamilton Hall on Columbia, right near these images that you're looking at, where when the police go in, that is where we anticipate this confrontation will happen. We saw the students occupy it, and whoever else was with them. Broken windows. And the first thing when you see that broken window, I'm thinking of that indelible image of the Capitol.
Yeah.
Far-right protesters on January 6th. Here we are on April 30th. People who would identify themselves as far-left protesters.
Right.
Doing the same thing.
Well, you do have to ask if there's a through line from one to the other. I mean, January 6th, we had a president still at the time, now a former president, who has romanticized what's happened there, who has sent the message that if you really believe in something and if you're fighting for it, you do the most provocative, disruptive, confrontational thing possible. That's what the rioters on January 6th did. That's what these students and their non-student allies, whatever we want to call them, are doing here. There's this, it's all the same sort of ethos, the same sort of approach.
And it is all, Chief Ramsey, going to be, I would imagine, on camera, because there are people involved who are going to want every bit of it on camera.
Oh, it'll be on camera, but it is what it is. I mean, you know, you just can't have this sort of thing take place on a regular basis. I mean, 2 years ago, it was U.S. Capitol. Today, it's Columbia. I mean, what's next? I mean, it just goes on and on. This is not a peaceful protest any longer. You cannot go into a building. You cannot vandalize. This has got nothing to do with a peaceful protest. These are people that are there for a whole different purpose, and the police will have to take care of it. And believe me, NYPD will. And the reason you see so many police officers is because you want to have overwhelming numbers. That actually keeps the violence down and makes it less likely that people will get hurt.
All right. Well, we continue to monitor this. These are live pictures from the other side of Columbia, where the surge units are on the other side of the campus, as we are watching what it seems to be an imminent confrontation that may occur here on the Columbia campus. Chief Ramsey is going to stay with us. Frank Bruni, thank you so much. And The Age of Grievance, your book, of course, one I hope that everyone watching in light even of this specific instance will want to read. We will come back with our breaking coverage right after this break.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Breaking news. These are the live pictures outside Columbia University here in New York City tonight. Hundreds of the city's police are outside the campus as pro-Palestinian protesters continue to occupy a school building, now in defiance of university orders. Moments ago, the mayor of New York said the situation, quote, must end now. There are hundreds of surge unit police on the other side of the campus. With visors ready to be pulled down and go in. And we have reporters there monitoring exactly what is happening. Out front now is Eric Cortalesa. He is a Time reporter who spoke to Trump, Donald Trump, for nearly 90 minutes. And I know, Eric, you made a lot of headlines, and especially in context of this breaking news that is unfolding before our eyes tonight. You asked Trump in these extensive conversations you had, 90 minutes over two interviews, if he would call in the military to break up these protests on college campuses. What did he tell you?
Well, thanks for having me, Aaron. Yes, I asked Donald Trump about this in the context of comments he reportedly made to his former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who wrote in his book that Trump suggested during the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020 that he order the shooting of protesters in the leg. Donald Trump didn't deny that he said that. He disparaged Esper as his worst Secretary of Defense. When I asked whether he would be willing to send the military on protesters as president, he said he likely wouldn't have to because he would rely mostly on the National Guard.
And mostly on the National Guard. So, you know, just it's just important context in light of these images. Obviously, Speaker Mike Johnson called for the National Guard days ago at Columbia. That hasn't yet happened, but we do see these, you know, as our reporter said, the most surge police that he's ever seen covering protests in New York right now, massed outside the gates of Columbia University. You know, you talked to Trump about political violence as well. And, you know, we'll see what happens here. But of course, from the left, many would characterize this as politically driven violence. On the right, of course, there was January 6th. So you asked Trump whether he was worried there'd be political violence this November, election month. He told you no, but I know you followed up with him in your extensive conversations. And he told you, and let me quote from you, Eric, if we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of an election. Tell me more.
Yeah, I mean, that really stood out to me. In our first conversation at Mar-a-Lago, roughly 2 weeks ago, I asked whether he was worried about political violence in connection with the November election, and he said no. And I said, well, do you expect anything? He said, I think we're going to win. I think there won't be political violence. So when I had a chance to talk with him again on the phone 2 weeks later, I followed up on that and said, you know, Mr. President, what if you don't win? And he said precisely what you just said. And, you know, it stood out to me because he raised the specter of potential political violence if he doesn't win the election, which was alarming to many people.
Right, certainly, and especially considering that, you know, his definition of what is a free election, at least in the last election, is not the definition of what a free election is. So what else struck you the most over these conversations that you had? And again, in 90 minutes, what else stood out to you, Eric?
You know, what stood out to me was the fact that, you know, Trump is ever more assertive and confident now than he's ever been. He is in the process of embarking on a strategic plan to return to the White House and be able to seize more power than he had in a first term, right? He is trying to consolidate power around his position as president and remove many of the guardrails that prevented him from carrying out a lot of the things he wanted to do in the first term. He's got a conservative army of advisors and aides who are preparing the mechanics of carrying out his agenda. And he is preparing right now to go into office if he wins to hit the ground running in a way that he wasn't prepared to the last time.
And just as you're watching, talking, Eric, everyone, you're looking on your screen at those surge unit police. You hear students yelling from a distance, why are you in riot gear? And those police with their visors prepared to go into Columbia University as you're seeing this face-off here. Eric, you in your conversations with Trump, as we're watching this again unfold, you asked him about something he said to Sean Hannity when he talked about on day one. He says, Trump says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? He's talking about a conversation with someone. And he tells this person, no, other than on day one. What did he explain to you about that?
Well, you know, Trump essentially said that he was joking, that he was kidding around, that he was playing with the audience. You know, Trump often is able to assume this role of almost stand-up comedian when he's in front of an audience, when he's at his rallies. It's part of his relationship with his supporters. He entertains them as well as speaks to them. But when I said, well, sir, don't you realize that this kind of talk of dictatorship strikes many Americans as contrary to our most fundamental democratic principles?
Yes.
He said, no. In fact, he said, I think a lot of people like it.
Hmm. All right, Eric, thank you. And thanks to all of you. It's time for AC 360.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.